stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome to Administrative Static, and I'm John Vecchione. I'm joined by Janine Yunus, and we are also joined by our colleague, Kara Rollins, to discuss something a little different, which is there was a hearing in Congress before the House Committee on Financial Regulation. And what's interesting about it is that a number of issues came up that we have been arguing to beat the band should really be addressed, often by the courts, but also by Congress. Kara, what's going on?
Well, as I like to remind people, there's three branches of government. We typically deal with two, the executive and judicial branch. And sometimes the third branch, Congress, seems like they're out to lunch. But most recently, as of yesterday, they had a hearing in the House Financial Services Committee, one of their subcommittees on capital markets, and it was titled, much to my heart's content, SEC Enforcement, Balancing Deterrence with Due Process. And what it focused on is a lot of things that we at NCLA have both been litigating on and talking about publicly for years. Denial of due process rights through in-house adjudications, lack of jury trial rights, abusive processes in SEC investigations, use of disgorgement, settlements with gags in them. I mean, it was like a smorgasbord of the things that we have litigated over time and thought desperately, you know, there's a group of people up there that can fix this. And unfortunately, you know, we're left to the courts to deal with it. But, you know, there are other avenues.
So who do you know who chairs this?
That's Chair Wagner, Ann Wagner from, I believe, Missouri.
Okay. And do you know what prompted who do they have come in?
So they actually had a good friend of ours, Nick Morgan, from the Investor Choice Advocates Network. He's been a friend of NCLA literally multiple times by writing amicus briefs in several of our cases, including the gag cases. And, you know, he was on the Hill speaking specifically to two of their clients' experiences. Because I think, you know, there's this misunderstanding globally that, you know, if the agency comes after you, and this is true of all agencies, not just the SEC, that you're a bad guy and you did bad things. And as we've found, the agencies aren't particularly good necessarily of sussing out true bad actors versus people who might have just stumbled and didn't mean to stumble and aren't sort of doing the types of harms. Now, they do make those people into these big bad boogeymen because they do have to go to Congress and substantiate their well-being for the next fiscal year. But I think that it's really helpful, you know, when Nick or others get up in front of Congress to tell real stories about what this is. That's one of the reasons we're fighting the gag case. As many of our listeners know, the SEC has a rule which silences all maybe it's the chair calling me now to tell me that he's found the error of his ways. But that the SEC has a gag rule. It's been on the books since the 70s. And it essentially says that if you settle in a no admit, no deny basis with the commission, you can never sort of disparage the allegations in the complaint. And that we think fairly includes, and I think some of the testimony yesterday from some of the professors that were there and have long worked in the defense bar, even at the SEC itself, have said, like, even large publicly traded companies don't know where that line is. Like, can they tell their investors the reason we didn't settle sooner was X? Or does that violate the gag rule? I mean, that's a problem with it. I mean, that to me, like, again, it goes to this idea. It's a prior restraint on speech. It shouldn't be there. It appears that the committee is at least thinking about removing it. And one of the things I want to explain that's so wild about this is, and we cite this in our briefing on the gag rule, years ago, Congress passed a law that essentially gagged judges when they were in certain sorts of ethics concerns, and the courts roundly held that as unconstitutional. So, like, the fact that Congress has to step in to undo this unconstitutional thing that the agencies doing when Congress tried to do that unconstitutional thing before is just like it wasn't covered in Schoolhouse Rock, mm-hmm. and we should never have gotten here. Yeah. But it speaks to a lack of oversight. And, you know, if all of the targets of enforcement and 98% of SEC cases settle are silenced, then who's going to be there to talk about the abusive processes that the SEC engages with, their questionable theories of law? I mean, you and I have seen that in real time at trial.
And overcharging.
And overcharging.
I mean, that is something when you settle a case, I think this gag rule doesn't let you talk about all the things that were just overcharged.
Yeah.
And that you would definitely say that you didn't do, mm-hmm. But you settled on the things that were arguable or not. Yeah. And I don't see any real big problem with that, particularly when the SEC on its part is settling because there's a reason for it to settle. Like, it can't prove all the charges. So why would they care?
Yeah. No, I mean, the other agencies don't do this, right? And I thought there was something really interesting when our petition for rulemaking to
get rid of this
gag.
Folks do, but that's
yeah, it. That they're the only other ones we're aware of. That when the denial letter from the SEC on our petition for rulemaking to get rid of this exact gag rule came out, there's a dissent by Commissioner Peirce. And she essentially said, she goes, do we not trust our own enforcement attorneys? Like, there's something somewhat embarrassing that they feel like they need to essentially do an NDA to protect their enforcement attorneys from the work they're doing. But then we look at cases, and you know, I don't know if we talked about this on the show, but there's that debt box case back in Utah. This is like a crypto case where there was massive amounts of fabricated information in the ex parte TRO that was granted by the court. And what that means is the SEC went in to the court, said, we have all this evidence of fraud, freeze all the accounts, all this stuff. It was false. They got slapped so hard by the judge that I watched that docket. It was so many attorney removals and new people in and internal training. And the SEC tried to save face, but the agency only gets that way if there's no oversight or accountability.
Let me explain what happened there, because we had this also in a case we had when we were cause of action, the Violatech case, mm-hmm. is that they put in these cookie-cutter affidavits that say you have foreign assets or you're going to travel to some other
country. You're going to flee the country.
Yeah, or you're going to transfer assets to your wife or whatever you're going to do. Mm-hmm. And they put this all in an affidavit, and you don't get to say anything because it's under a TRO. You may not even have been served with a complaint. And they go before the judge and say, oh, you really got to freeze all accounts of everything. And then why do they do that? Oh, they say they're saving money for disgorgement and to get everyone back. But it's so you can't get a lawyer. That's what they're doing here.
And
let me just finish the thought here is, and then, okay, so that's bad enough. They do that so you can't get a lawyer. But oftentimes there are untrue statements in these. And the reason I say oftentimes is because we've seen it.
Yeah.
And the 11th Circuit reversed one of these things for somebody who wasn't even involved in the company, got their assets freezed when Kara and I were doing it. Mm-hmm. But here, it was worse, it sounds like.
Yeah, no, I mean, this was tremendous. And it was an absolute enormous amount of money. And it turned out they just didn't understand the fundamentals of the business or how the accounts were working. But they put in all this stuff. They're depleting assets, all this. To your point, disgorgement, and you know how John knows very personally how I feel about disgorgement. It can be an incredibly important equitable tool to get money back to harmed investors. However, the agencies use it to bludgeon people. And they don't, at least in the SEC's current understanding of the disgorgement law, though the Second Circuit recently changed this on them, believe that they need to gather information and identify harmed investors in order to make these claims. Guess what? You want to bludgeon people? Ask for a high civil penalty.
And okay, so that's the gag order. But there were other things at this hearing.
Disgorgement is one of the things on the table that was part of the conversation. And you know, as John and I have seen in the FTC context with disgorgement, we are fighting a disgorgement case right now that's on appeal to the 11th Circuit. The SEC didn't bother in a decade in our case, Spartan, to find one single harmed investor because they can't. There are none, because the money that they say comes and harmed people actually came from people who went to jail for fraud. And so, you know, this is where one of my bees in the bonnet on disgorgement is that it can be a really useful, helpful tool to actually help harmed investors. But that's not how the SEC uses it. They use it as another tool in their kit to bludgeon people into settlement, because they can run up the numbers on disgorgement. And essentially, they throw a number on the wall and they say, well, you know, the standard says you have to disprove this.
Right. And so you've got, we've got the gag order, which, as we say, only two agencies use. Even the FTC says no admit, no deny.
Yeah.
Don't deny
we've
these factual stuff, right?
Those,
don't,
yeah.
Right. Don't, but you're not admitting to anything we're charging you with. And you can speak at least about that. Look, yeah, I settled it, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, and in any event, what is, were there any other issues?
Well, the other one, and this is one of our colleague Russ Ryan's favorite issues, we've had this in cases, is like when you're doing a penalty calculation, how do you establish what a violation is? Because the SEC, we've seen this. This was our SEC versus Murphy case, which we took up to a cert petition. If I remember there, they took like the violations for a failure to have a license, if I'm remembering the details correctly. And they said, well, every month that you don't have the license or every week you don't have the license is a new violation. When like I would say like that's a binary violation, you either have a license or you don't. It's not like the clock resets.
Why not every minute?
Yeah. But to the point on the FTC, we've seen this. I've had FTC attorneys essentially say or argue in court, well, each violation under the FTC Act could mean that every day a statement is on a website, that's a violation. So in a year, you could have 360 violations. That's absurd.
Right. And then they always say they're doing you a favor. We've only pled 12,
yeah.
Right, by month, but we could have done it by day.
In Spartan.
Well, how is that law?
Yeah, in Spartan, our SEC case that's on appeal in the 11th Circuit, we beg them. How many violations? Please tell us the exact violations. Oh, there's a pile of violations. How will we ever know how many violations there are? Well, guess what? The jury did 13 of 14 counts out. And then at the remedy stage, they go, oh, well, there's 11 violations.
Yeah, no. So to wrap up, what's going to come of this?
I mean, this is just information gathering for several bills that are pending before the committee right now. So I think they're going to move through the process from here.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Hopefully something will come.